Hi, everybody.
Hey, Joseph.
Hello. We're going to continue our discussion of 2 weeks ago and expand it a little further. And this is regarding a chapter in Trialog Rinpoche's book, I believe chapter 7, which deals with the question of what is it that goes between lifetimes. And I had some trouble trying to figure out how to get the whole thing to cohere in a way that would make sense. And then I remembered a liturgy that I had been doing for the past year and a half or so. And part of it is a contemplation of the what are called the four reminders, which I know some of you have worked with. The precious human birth, the fact that our bodies are subject to decay and we will eventually die. Third one is karma, and the fourth one is the nature of the circle of samsara. And I remember the commentary on the karma contemplation said, actions are divided, actions being karma, are divided into three categories. There's defiled, undefiled, completely undefiled. Okay, what are defiled karmas? Three kinds of karma. Positive karma, negative karma, and neutral karma. So positive karma is defiled. Virtuous, non-virtuous, or neutral. And that's somewhat in line with our discussion 2 weeks ago, when we talked about the fact that we all have mixed motives and mixed intentions, and we try to do better, but you know, we also act with a twist and try to get things for ourselves, and you know, we're eager to pat ourselves on the back for how well we're doing and how patient we're being, when the fact is that we're just pissed off, all that stuff. So that's virtuous karma, was considered defiled. You might want to think about what the other two are. What is undefiled? Undefiled karma, he says, is conducive to liberation, which is actually would be the hook for tonight's talk. Then there's completely undefiled karma, which is conducive to, we'll call it wisdom or enlightenment or omniscience or whatever. So we're going to start by talking about liberation. And we could rhapsodize what we could fantasize about what liberation is, but what keeps us unliberated? And the teachings say there are two categories, or two things that keep us unliberated. Does anyone have a guess what some of them, what they might be? So, what keeps you stuck? We don't have to get that personal. What keeps all of us stuck? We don't have to do true confessions.
Is attachment one?
Attachment? That's a good one, because it actually covers two categories. You'll see.
Ego?
No? Ego? Yes. That's going to be the second one. The second factor, but it has a funny name to it. Okay. Anyone want to take a wild guess?
Well, I've seen it categorized otherwise as conflicting emotions and false views of reality, but I don't know if that's from this catalog or a different one.
You should be on Jeopardy. You might beat that guy. That's exactly where I'm going, Michael.
Delusion?
What's that?
Delusion?
Okay. Well, okay. Afflictive or conflicting emotions is one of them. Okay, we talked about that a lot. And we know that our emotions cause us to misperceive ourselves, misperceive reality, do things that are stupid, make apologies after the fact, get us into trouble, and basically cause us misery. Okay, I think that's obvious to all of us. That's the afflictive emotion, sometimes called conflicting emotions. The Sanskrit is klesha. The Tibetan turns out to mean like sort of like nuisance mind. Then there's what Herbert Gunter calls primitive beliefs about reality. And that's where liberation comes in. So we have to talk about primitive beliefs about reality. Now, I noticed 2 weeks ago and also 6 weeks or a month before that, we were talking about like how much like Buddhist philosophy drives them crazy and all these schools and this and that. And I thought about that, also thinking about our discussion 2 weeks ago. And we have been miseducated in terms of what, quote, philosophy is for. Because the way that we use some of these ideas is to cut through our primitive beliefs about reality. The fact is we all have beliefs. We all have ingrained ideas. They're so ingrained we're not even aware. You know, it's like if everything is blue, nothing is blue. It's just part of who we are. And of course, one of those primitive beliefs about reality has to do with what we call ego. That's a primitive belief about reality. And we'll get there. So, Buddhist philosophy is a centuries-old exercise in deconstructing our concepts, in trying to get down to what is it that we actually are thinking when we're thinking in a confused way. And so there are different ideas, and the Tibetans put them as sort of a progression. I haven't said anything important yet.
Michael did.
You have to listen to the recording for that. So we have these concepts that are just there. And so we examine those concepts. You know, what do we mean when we talk about our body, when we talk about our mind? What's our experience? And there are different ways of approaching it in Buddhism. We have meditation as a really prominent sort of empirical research laboratory. Not that you have to, and I don't want you to sit down and say, okay, what's my body, what's my mind, what's the meaning of life, you don't philosophize on the cushion, you simply be with yourself. But we reflect. And so we also can talk to each other and compare ideas and sort of investigate things. And from the time of the Buddha, for many, many centuries, there have been these waves of possibilities that dismantle our so-called primitive beliefs about reality. Right? So when we talk about, quote, philosophy, we're not talking about what passes for philosophy in academia. We're talking about our curious, inquisitive mind that's not afraid to ask questions and to see where our understanding takes us and to acknowledge that sometimes we're like dead wrong. And that should be actually good news, not some kind of personal defeat. So then we have to ask, in the spirit of inquiry, who are we, what is our world, right? Yes, this has a lot to do with it, karma and reincarnation and all the stuff that Trawa Rinpoche talks about in this chapter. Now, what is our world we're not going to get into? I think that's a little too vast for our conversation today, but... I could ask Roberta, but, you know... She'll board something out, which is totally amazing. But who are we? Well, let's be obvious. We know that we are physically here. We have a body. We have a body. We start with body. Okay? We spend a lot of energy clothing, washing, thinking about feeding, trying to get into shape, this thing we call body. It's amazing how much of our daily energy is simply on maintaining this body that not only just survives biologically, but interacts with other bodies in the world. We can't exactly find a body, but we know that there's body. We know that there's a physical dimension of our life. And, you know, you practice meditation and you're still for a while and you notice that you have a body. It starts to rebel. Okay. We also know that our body influences our mind a lot. That our mind is, you know, are we comfortable? Are we uncomfortable? Have we had enough sleep? What's it feel like when we don't? If you're feeling under the weather or you have like a physical thing, that your mind spends a lot of time there. But then we have to ask, what is this thing called mind? Because we also know that aside from having a physical presence, we think about things a lot. Sometimes out in within, sometimes outside. Okay? This is all, we all know this. We've known this since we were like three. So we have a body, we have a mind. So, what is mind? Is mind the same as body? Is it different from body?
Yes. Yes, both.
I'm going to put you on the spot. Is it totally different or sort of different?
From body?
Yeah.
It's not totally different because the mind... I want to say it's attached to the body, but not the physical sense, but that sort of it doesn't stop thinking about the body.
It thinks about other things too.
Yeah, but it never stops thinking about the body. Or maybe
never.
It does.
I don't know. I sit and I think about all kinds
but
of
I,
things.
But it doesn't, like, it's not like at some point you'll stop doing that before you die. So not like you do it every minute of the day.
True. Okay. So, our body is sort of composite, but so is our mind. It thinks different things. Okay? If the body is exactly the same as mind, or we can call it consciousness if we want, then when we die, our mind dies with our body. Right? And that is the basic materialistic, scientific approach that's sort of prevalent in our modern culture. Now, of course, there's some problems with that. And Trawa Rinpoche talks about that a little in his chapter on the empirical dimension of reincarnation, or rebirth. That we have near-death experiences. Now, we could. The boundary between life and death is very fluid, and people have experienced sort of being around the room and looking down at their body. So we have strong evidence for that. We also have some evidence for, sometimes people talk about past life memories which have worked out. So we also know that there are people who attest to being in a coma and going someplace and coming back into their body. So from an empirical scientific point of view, you can't say for sure that the body and the mind die together. Although, when our body dies, we're pretty dead. You know, we don't die from a mind deciding to go somewhere else. We die from a certain physical condition. Susan?
Well, you don't know that. I mean, you haven't died, so...
True. No. But most of the time, when somebody dies, they say, they died, hopefully for me, old age and serenity. Extreme old age and happiness. Other people die from other things. We can die, you know, we know that our life can hangs by a thread, and we, you know, we could die any time. So we can't say that the body and the mind are the same. Are they different? Are they different? And here we can talk about body in terms, or mind in terms of awareness. We can talk about it in terms of soul. And there are different possibilities. Those of us who were raised, especially Catholic, we have heaven, hell, purgatory. And the idea is that you die and you go someplace intact. Except you don't have a body. You're sort of like a bodiless, bodiless you, which was very strong in the medieval Christian tradition, and you don't hear much about it since. It shows up in, like, the Divine Comedy, of course, and TV shows every once in a while, and New Yorker cartoons. Cartoons with, you know, Peter's Gate, and, you know, or my favorite Far Side cartoon. There's a devil in front of two doors. One says damned if you do, the other one says damned if you don't. So it's part of our culture, but I don't know of anyone who, you know, gets literal about it. There's also the idea of reincarnation from a traditional Indian point of view, the idea that there's a soul that migrates through lifetimes, kind of like an actor in different episodes of a drama or different dramas, or I think the Bhagavad Gita talks about, like, you know, when you change your clothes. You know, just changing clothes from one life to another lifetime. And, you know, there's a certain power to that, but it runs into some problems. It's like, okay, is this soul unchangeable? Is it changeable? Is it one? Is it many? Who is it? Is it you? Is it not you? What are the qualities of this entity that seems to survive? And in our culture, we're, even if we don't know it, we're often influenced by the whole theosophical slant, which is a hybrid of Christian and Hindu, which is sort of the developing soul during lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And I've always had this question, like, how can an immortal soul change from one lifetime to, or learn from one lifetime to the next? So these are possibilities that are, we have the nihilist, and then we have these sort of soul or immortality kinds of schools of thought. And they have a lot of emotional power. They have a lot of cultural power. Those of you who've been to Europe have seen maybe some of all those Last Judgment pictures of the, you know, the damned going to hell and are miserable and they're going on the left all the way down. And
Europe?
Europe. Are they right here too?
I don't know.
Right here.
I think the MFA might have.
The MFA probably, yeah, they probably stole it from Europe.
Yeah.
And you have the angels and you have all the saved and they look so serene. And okay. But I think we can do a little better as Buddhists and be a little clearer on what we mean. And this is how meditation really helps, because it allows us to be with our awareness. And it also allows us to be with the objects of our awareness, our thoughts, and our perceptions, and all the things the mind was doing while we were sitting. And so I have a...
Do you have a list of those?
No. Actually, you could make a list, but I think it'd be too long.
Yeah.
If you've done a lot of sitting, or you've been on a retreat, and sometimes your mind can get so slow you can actually see the little flickerings of thoughts from second to second to second to second to second. Most of the time in our busy lives, we sit down and it's like, you know, blah, 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 blah. So, here's a mala, 108 beats, okay? We're doing an analogy here.
What's it called?
It's called a mala, M-A-L-A.
It's 108 times.
108 times. Okay. It's basically composed... And by the way, this was imported into medieval Europe, and this was where the Christian rosary comes from. Those of us who use the rosary once upon a time. Yes, for some of us, there's no escape. As a kid, I had a rosary, and as an adult, I have a few malas. That's not quite rebirth or reincarnation. I don't know what that is. Okay, so
recycling.
Yes. Leftovers.
So, what do you call a crazy Jewish student of Buddhist philosophy?
I bet this is gonna be good.
Michael?
Jewish student. Call him Michael? That's good. Michael Levin.
About Yarmulke?
Yarmulke.
That's very good.
That's awful.
I'm sorry. I love puns. That's great. Okay. Beads and a string. We know when we practice meditation that, you know, we have thoughts, right?
We have what?
Thoughts. Thoughts. We have perceptions, okay? This happens or this happens. I want to go to San Francisco. Maybe the Golden State Warriors will be in the finals with the Celtics. Why do I care? On and on. Who's that who just sat in back of me? Etc., etc. You know what our minds do. We can be here. We can be there. We have thoughts, we have sensations, we have urges. How long is Elisa going to not look at the clock? You know, et cetera, et cetera.
Forever.
It's like, it's going to be 10 o'clock if she notices what time it is. Et cetera. We all do this. We also do this off the cushion. We just don't notice it. But on the cushion, it's like we have this flashlight. And we can actually see that there's all these things that are sort of they're not continuous. You know, we can be angry with somebody. What does the anger consist of? This angry thought and that angry thought and this fantasy and that angry thought. And then it's like, why am I sitting? I really have to do something else right now. Or I wish I decided to pee before I started sitting. And that's angry thought. So there's a discontinuity. We often do not notice discontinuity because we're so busy in our lives. But we have discontinuity. We notice it when we're sitting. That's why people often find sitting so frightening. It's because it's discontinuous. there are gaps. You know, we have a technique. We breathe out. And it's like, there's nothing, all of a sudden there's like nothing to keep me company. But something to keep me company always comes up. Has it ever happened that it's like, I can't stand doing this. One more minute of this, I am done. And then we're off to the next thing. So we all know what the beads are. 108 million billion trillion things that pass through our mind. Okay. What do these beads consist of? Well, there's an object, internal or external. You know, I was sitting back of Megan looking at her sweater. That was an external object of thought. It's like, did she get that on her trip or she always had that? I don't know, but I'll think about it for the next 5 minutes. So there's an object, and sometimes it's internal. So the question is, what's the string holding together our thoughts? Elise, I'll start with you. What's the string holding together our thoughts?
We like to think it's me.
Yes. What is me?
I didn't hear what you said.
We like to think it's me. I'm holding it together.
I thought it was me.
There is a philosophy joke like
what?
That. Oh, what? Major philosopher talks about solipsism, which is basically the only thing I can be sure of is that I exist. And she comes up to him and says, I'm glad you think that. I've been thinking that the same way my entire life. Now, that is logically impossible, because she can't think, she can't be the person whose world is constructed around her at the same time the philosopher's world is constructed around him. Sorry to explain the joke.
Is that a joke?
That was a joke.
For philosophers.
I find it very funny.
Okay.
Anyway. So, there are continuities. Before we get into, we're going to deconstruct me a little bit. All right? Me and you and you and you. Okay, there are continuities. We know this. We have the physical continuity. You know, we're going to be stuck with the same body after sitting as we had before we were sitting, and the one that we experienced while sitting, and going through our life. We look in the mirror, it's pretty much the same person. We just look a little older, maybe a little uglier sometimes. There's also... What?
So I have a question. But actually, isn't it happening? We say it's the same body when we start as a little baby, and I mean, it's not. It's really never the same body. We think it's the
right.
same body, but it's
yes,
not.
Exactly. But there's some kind of flow. I mean, if you looked in the mirror and you were, you know, bald and looked like a guy,
suddenly I'd say, well, yeah,
you'd be really confused.
Yeah, right.
And there are continuities in our world. We're
so,
all, we, yes.
But I was thinking it's not like my car. My car can suddenly look totally different because I could get a new one.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, that's a good one. I think most of us drove here today. We're going to get, you know, my car is sort of aqua. I have a Honda. You have something else. We all pretty much know what the car is going to look like when we get out of here. Or if it doesn't, there's a reason. Someone stole it. Someone spray painted it. Someone took the hubcaps or the tires off. Whatever. Not that kind of neighborhood. So we have a lived world that has continuities. We have a physical person that has continuities. When we look further at our world and at our person, we realize that things are not as continuous as we think they are. They're sort of predictable, but that can change. you know, the first, one of the first teachings is on impermanence. And the fact is, we could walk out of here and the world could be completely different. It's possible. I don't know why it would be. But now, with this continuity, we have, do these continuities account, are they separate from our minds? Are they separate from the world that we have created? We can actually look at them and see that the continuities that we experience are actually somewhat flimsy. So this became a source of difficulty for people who believed in a soul. And the Buddhist teachings came up saying that these continuities are only illusory. And the Vedanta folks decided that what keeps this together is awareness, is consciousness. That we have the same awareness that simply thinks different things or experiences different things, but it's the same awareness. And that's the Vedanta, these are the Vedanta folks. And it's a very powerful, very attractive rendition of reality. The problem is that, first, in our experience, every awareness has an object. We notice what we're breathing out. That's not a gap in awareness. That's simply an awareness that's focused. And then it moves into something else. So there's also, awareness is, if you're looking for it as a thing, as sort of an essence of you, then you're going to get into trouble, because our experience is not an experience of awareness, it's an experience of the objects, the content of our experience, what our awareness is aware of. You know, whether it's the purple shirt on Roberta, or the wondering what kind of a watch Tom has because my wife just ordered one, or that's a really nice bag that Elise has. So there's no, is there awareness outside from its objects? So when you are reflecting on that, these things, figure it out. This is not highfalutin stuff that you can't examine. This is for your examination. Look at awareness and the object of awareness. See how, are they the same or are they different? If they're the same, then how do you get from one awareness to the other? If they're different, how do you account for the fact that our awareness seems to flow in some kind of a steady stream? So this is all stuff that is conducive to liberation, because it will drive a nail into some primitive beliefs about reality. Let's see, what was I going to say next? So, what does this have to do with karma? And what happens between lifetimes and the idea of multiple lifetimes? The Buddhist middle way is that the continuity is provided by our karma. It is not that the beads and the string are separate, but our thoughts propel us along organically. Our thoughts propel us into activity that propels into an environment that comes back as life conditions. We can see this in an hour of meditation. We can see this in a lifetime. Hypothetically, we can see this between lifetimes. That the same mechanism between one thought and the next is exactly the same as between lifetime and lifetime. It's just a matter of scale. Trungpa Rinpoche, this is a wonderful but daunting book. We'll talk about the fact that we die and get reborn every time we one thought goes to the next.
Is this a recent book?
Yes, it just came out like 3 months ago. It's got the Karma Seminar and various things in that you've seen. So any questions or thoughts on that? Karma is between... So karma is the string.
What does it add to saying it's this, the previous descriptions of the continuity? What does karma add to saying it's something continuous?
Okay, a couple things. First of all, it doesn't get caught in the polarity of mind and body being the same thing, or mind and body being totally separate. That what brought this body was my mind and my activity, and I'm propelled from birth to birth. That's why Buddhists talk not about reincarnation, as if there's one thing that kind of goes from lifetime to lifetime, but rebirth. What's it a what?
We had this
conversation rebirth. Like every week?
No.
Were you aware of the cake that said Happy Rebirth last week?
Happy Rebirth Day.
Happy Rebirth Day cake.
Happy Birthday.
It was for three people who had birthdays April 29th.
That's great.
This one.
And Emily.
Yeah. Emily.
Happy Rebirth Day. I love it.
Could it also be said to be habits?
Yes.
Habit is what is habit but a crystallization of karmic tendencies that have a life of their own. And so from one lifetime, we are propelled through our latent habits to the next one. If the conditions are correct, certain habits will reemerge as conditions.
How does the alaya fit into all this? Because I thought that the karma was supposed to reside there.
Yes, but the alaya is not a thing. The alaya is a mental construct. Meaning, it's a useful fiction that we have to think of awareness and continuity of awareness and the propulsion more as verbs than nouns. So, so there's no thing attached to it, but it's a set of tendencies. And it's very convenient to think of it as somehow in a storehouse of some kind. But we can't find the storehouse, although we know that we carry around in our brains either specific memories or things, you know, like things that we did when we were young that are sort of in here anyway. You know, I think I can ride a tricycle, but I haven't ridden a tricycle since I was about 3. By the time I was 5, I thought tricycles were not cool at all. And I like to use the analogy of my bad German. I learned German when I was in high school. I have forgotten a lot of it, but put me in Germany for a couple days. It'll come back. So these are latent tendencies. And what we're talking about here is that's within one lifetime, but that can happen within a 20-minute span of time. That can happen within multiple lifetimes. So what gets reborn is our habitual tendencies. So you may be asking, well, what is liberating about that? That sounds really depressing.
It seems more to me that you're saying it so, but I don't know that I have seen any evidence that it's so.
That what is so?
That something continues from a lifetime to a lifetime. That
But what is it that continues? There are people with memories of previous lifetimes, but they usually, by the time they're like 6 or 8, those memories go away.
That I've seen happen.
I have an analogy. How many people here have seen the TV show Third Rock from the Sun?
What?
Third Rock from the Sun.
Was that the one of Tina Fey?
No.
It
was like 20.
John Lithgow.
Yeah,
John Lithgow is a bunch of aliens.
Oh, I've heard of it.
Oh, it's really silly and occasionally it's hilarious. But this is one of those times I was like watching it and it struck me that this show was brilliant. Because what you have are these aliens from other places in the galaxy and they're in different bodies. One is a like a 13-year-old adolescent discovering his sexuality. The other one is a 20-year-old attractive woman trying to figure out how to do relationships. And then the John Lithgow character is a getting a little bit old, middle-aged guy. And then there's another character who's hilarious, who's sort of like a Asperger's teenager.
And they name them Tom, Dick, and Harry.
Yes.
Because they're these aliens. They have to take on human bodies because they have to live in the world. And so they probably found somewhere, it's, you know, like Tom, Dick, and Harry.
Yes.
Their names.
So what happened, what's fun about the show is that these entities, because of the bodies they're in, because of the hormones they have, because of how they appear to others, are not the same people who were the aliens who came, before they came in. They're completely different. And it's brilliant because it shows us what happens. It's like an experiment of what happens between lifetimes. As much as a work of art we have made out of ourselves and our identities and our history and all the stories we like to tell about ourselves and all the reference points in our lives and all the good books we've read and all the great music that we've listened to, we die, it's all going to go. It all goes away. There's no you if you want to define yourself conditionally as you.
And all the regrets we had.
All the regrets and all the joys.
One of the more unsettling movies I've seen is Bergman's Wild Strawberries.
I haven't seen that for a long time. I don't remember it.
That is a very unsettling view of reality.
What was it?
Wild Strawberries.
Isn't that one of those kind of real classic?
Oh, it's
yeah. I'll have to. I'll have to check it out.
Okay, I didn't realize so few people had seen it.
I've seen it, but many years ago.
I don't remember it.
50 years ago.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Eric Erickson talks about it as childhood and society. He has a whole chapter just analyzing that in terms of stages of life. See, even that vague memory goes away when I die. Instead,
it could go away before.
Somehow it came back.
Yeah.
You know, it's weird how, you know, things will come to mind. I'm sure this happens to all of us. That, you know, it's like, how did I think of that? I haven't thought of that since I was like 12. It all goes away. What? The string, however, is not any of these beads. You know, I am Joe Crane, I do this, I do that, I have this history, my grandfather was Antonio Monese, he came from Italy, blah, blah, blah. All these reference points. All the beads go away. What we are left with is not an immortal soul, but we have what has propelled us. Our inclinations, our habits, the seeds of the next lifetime.
Then why is it some people can remember things from previous lives?
Because that's the question of the brain and the mind.
You've seen this with children.
I've seen it with my child.
Yeah.
All right.
Gwen, when she was 3 or 4 told me that she was born, before she was born to me, she was born to my husband's mother. And I asked her...
Oh my goodness, a reincarnational relative.
So I asked her, then how did she become born to me? And she said, well, actually I wasn't born. She was going to have me, and then I decided it wasn't right. So I came to you. And it turns out she didn't know, and I didn't know, that my mother-in-law had a miscarriage, and it was a girl.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Increasingly, our culture is receptive to hearing kids talk about these things. I mean, obviously, your daughter was raised in an environment where that could come up as a conversation without somebody being like totally freaked out.
She wanted to be around to be able to go to CERN. She's at the
Large Hadron Collider. She works at CERN, the Large
Hadron
Collider.
That's hilarious. Okay, is that one? Okay.
The particle accelerator.
Okay.
Wouldn't be
Switzerland. But it came up when I was tucking her in. I said, I'm so glad you were born to me. And she said, I wasn't born to you always. And I'm like, okay, so what? Tell me what happened.
This is one freaky kid.
And she was very serious,
yes.
But not upset.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she said, I was born to grandma beforehand.
Yeah.
And then she corrected it. She said, well, I didn't actually get born.
Mm.
And I said, so what happened? She said, well, I decided it wasn't right. Mm. But I still wanted to be in this family.
So.
Oh. And that was it. That was the end of the discussion and never came up again.
Okay. That brings up two things. One is the fact that it's almost like our mind needs to use the brain to live in this body on this planet. So it has specific memories. When we die, in some cases, the residues of the brain, some of them at least live with the mind from lifetime to lifetime. I think that's why you have not only near-death experiences, but you have people with precognition previous to birth. People talk about experiences of being in the womb and being born. And they've come out as you know, validated. It's like, you know, conditions. Exactly. When I was born, this was going on, that was going on, and it was this color room, and it was actually true. So the brain-mind thing is somewhat fluid, although I think what I tend to think is karmically the mind uses the brain to have memories and to be in this body and to do life. But there's a lot more to learn. The other factor, though, is intention. Your daughter had an intention. And liberation is replacing the compulsiveness of karma with intention. So, a person, and some of us aspire to this quite actively, form is called bodhicitta, form an intention to be reborn to be a benefit to others. And as that intention gets stronger, as the load of our habitual mental patterns get weaker, as we understand the fluidity of life better, then intention can propel us, instead of karma, toward the next birth. And of course, the Tibetan tradition is full of these stories of tulkus, like the Dalai Lama, who will predict, like, I'm going to be born in such and such a place and such parents and things like that. And maybe yes, maybe no, but I think for us here, we can work on forming the intention to be of benefit. And the best way to be of benefit is to cut through afflictive emotions and primitive beliefs about reality, so we can go from lifetime to lifetime intentionally as opposed to compulsively. So that's sort of the bottom line for, in terms of the Mahayana tradition. Yes?
What if we have a thought or have an intention that we don't want to do that? I mean, is that we're just not a Buddhist?
Sure.
So, you mean, what if you have something that you don't want to
be reborn?
Then you have to do the full-on shalada. You have to become completely liberated, Roberta.
Oh,
right, as you die.
You could say, "This, I am the Buddha, this is my last life."
Mm-hmm. No, I would think people die all the time and don't have the intention of being reborn.
Right, and so what happens is, without intention, we passively go from thing to thing.
Okay, yeah, I told Emily I was, I'm going to come back as a frog, I know it. And she says, oh, don't say that, it will come true. I'm like, oh, geez, I didn't say it. So,
well, you could decide to be a Buddha to the frog community.
Yeah.
And you'll come back to liberate all frogs.
But can't you die without being liberated? I mean, you just.
Most people die without being liberated. That's called samsara.
And they're just carried forth into frogness or horseness or whatever.
It depends on the current. Well, first of all, this is not a one-shot deal. We have accumulated tendencies, habits over a long, 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 long time. And so you may have a lifetime as a frog. It'll be a short lifetime. They don't live that long. Yeah.
Somebody might step on you.
Yes, I'm sure.
That's what we're all doing here, Roberta.
I just put
stepping on frogs.
Was that song, be kind to,
Web-footed friends.
Friends.
The dog might be somebody's mother.
Yeah. You ever look?
Previous
do you have pets at home?
I have grubs in the backyard. And I bought organic stuff to put on them.
Okay.
So they would stop eating my grass. And I'm not supposed to do this. If I'm a Buddhist, I'm not supposed to harm anything.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you've ever been close up with a grub. about the ugliest thing in the world.
Slugs are ugly.
I'm going to come back as a grub.
Okay.
Kill me now.
True justice.
Put it this way. If we lead lifetimes, grub-like lifetimes, then there's a greater chance that we will be passively compelled into a grub-like lifetime. So we don't do that.
Eating grubs.
Huh?
Eating the grubs.
Yeah.
Or maybe you'll be a Buddha to liberate all grubs. I don't know. Yes, of course.
What is samsara?
It's samsara.
Samsara.
Okay, it's a kind of perfume.
Okay, I'll pick that up.
It's a guy, Sam.
No, there's a perfume called samsara. I guess the word sounds nice.
No, it's
No,
it's named that because people sometimes find samsara attractive.
That
it would be a perfume
also.
Of that name.
Samsara is the opposite of the idea that we progress from lifetime to lifetime till we get the big thing. Is that we have a tendency to go around in circles.
Living or dead.
Yeah.
Samsara is a circle of misery which is self-reinforcing and goes in circles.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the basic definition of it.
It's not how we live, mostly.
And what Indian philosophies such as Buddhism, Hinduism, Vedanta, all talk about liberation from the cycle of rebirth, of samsara.
Going around in circles,
yes.
And getting nowhere.
Correct.
Yeah. It's basically in Hinduism you talk about when you die, the body dies. Your soul again changes from
right.
What you do from what you have done in your life.
Mm.
So on the basis of that, you becomes like a frog or whatever other
right.
form.
Right. Yeah. Now the important thing, as Trungpa Rinpoche would say, is nobody's keeping score. There's nobody out there deciding what you'll come back as. It's completely your... It's totally up to you.
But you, when you, that whatever that you is then a frog or a grub, you can't imagine there'd be any awareness or continuity of that particular you.
I've looked at my dog in the eye and I said... What would it be like if I was like in a dog's body and brain? It's a really interesting kind of mind, not just mind experiment, but sort of emotional experiment to do. Because my dog has awareness, he has a lot of the same emotions I have. He is sometimes very clever in a self-serving way. He certainly knows how to flirt with everybody who wants to get to like him. He's a lot like me, but he's a dog body.
But you wouldn't know. But if you were a dog, you would not then have the awareness of dogness.
Right.
So
it'd be very difficult. Once I'm a dog, it's very hard to not be a dog.
So this thing, any concern that you might have about becoming a grub or a frog, it's like not you anymore. So you wouldn't. It's not a
problem. Still don't want to do it.
But think of it, Robert. Think for all of us.
Yeah.
All of us. We are reborn as babies. Okay, we're babies. We have our. We don't have our memory. We have our karma, but we are babies in a totally different environment. Except for maybe your daughter.
I think of dogs as being sort of natural Buddhas because they live in the now. I mean, they're always in now. They're not going, I wish I'd done that yesterday, or tomorrow I'm planning to do this, and they're not.
I've seen dogs playing.
Walt Whitman has a wonderful poem about that. I'll find it for you.
Okay.
About the animals, you say, I love to hang out with the animals, they don't whine about their condition.
I love it, yes. They don't whine and...
Yeah, and mope and feel bad about
and they
themselves.
Don't, apologize to God and beg for forgiveness.
Exactly.
And
that's pretty much,
that's pretty much
what Whitman
great.
Says. That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
Great poem. But you don't want to come back as an animal. For what Susan just said. You just do what you do. You're hardwired to do most of the things you do. You don't have choices. You don't refrain except when you're really afraid that somebody's going to do something you don't like. You know, they're very instinctual. It's, my dog has a fine lifetime. He's okay, but I don't want his dog. I don't want his lifetime. There's no liberation there.
Well, it's the precious human birth. I mean, really, it's precious. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, it's not only that. When we say that, when we born, we don't decide we are going to born in the poor family or the rich family. Yeah. We are going to be the fit or we are handicapped at the time of the birth, right?
So you might decide
on the basis of the karma what you do.
You might decide what is the situation that I would have that I want to liberate all sentient beings. What kind of birth would give me the best opportunity? Maybe I have to pick the most dangerous time in human history because I'm to be born, because that's when I'm needed the most. Many of us did that.
Gautama Shakyamuni was part of the 1%. Shakyamuni, the Buddha. He was born, as a prince. He was the one. He's a 1%. He wasn't the rest of us. Okay, we run over a little bit. good. And so next week, I believe, Michael, you and Emily are going to wrap things up with this book. That's what I
guess so. Well, we're going to make quite a mess of it.
I look forward to hearing it. And I'll be back here on the 16th. I don't know what group is doing. But okay. How do we close up?